This show was brought to you by MKB Bank, SAS, and EY's Forensic and Integrity Services team. Hello everyone, welcome to the Defense Lines, Hungary's first podcast on the control functions in banking, insurance and corporate sectors. My name is András Bácsfalvi and I'm your host for the show that brings you real value and hands-on takeaways from the field of compliance, anti-money laundering, IT security, fraud prevention, risk management and internal audit. In order to achieve these ambitious goals, I'm gonna be joined by my colleagues who are not just the best in what they do, but they also have inspiring personalities that helps them through their journey of their professional lives. My today's guest is Jamie Kelly. He began his legal career at Freehill, Hollingdale and Page in Sydney. From 2008 to 2016, Jamie held senior legal and compliance posts with Standard Chartered Bank based in Singapore, most recently as the group head of legal and compliance. Prior to joining Standard Chartered Bank, Jamie had gained extensive experience in legal and compliance roles with General Electric and Citibank. In October 2016, he joined Westpac, one of the biggest banks in Australia, and he has been leading the compliance function for the Westpac Group since then. Hi Jamie, welcome to the Defense Lines. Thank you for accepting my invitation.
It's a pleasure, Andres, and great to speak to all your listeners out there and great to, you know, make a contribution to the Hungarian compliance community.
Thank you for that. You started your compliance career at General Electric, but since 2008, you have been always working in the financial sector. What are the key similarities and the main differences between corporate and banking compliance?
Yeah, look, so I did start at GE after being a lawyer for a little while and also at Citi before that, and then went to GE. And GE was a great company to work for because it had a really good corporate culture and a great program around the spirit and letter and integrity and trying to make sure that people knew the standard that needed to be set. It also had many different parts of it. So it had ranged from aircraft engines to power systems to healthcare, right across to some financial services, which I worked across all of that. I think the similarities are that a really strong culture and tone from the top is vital to make the compliance job work. The differences are that the risks are different from a financial services entity to other entities. Within GE, we'd have areas that were very highly regulated, such as healthcare or power systems, but the risks weren't your traditional AML or sales practices or suitability or things like that. They were much more around competition or anti-bribery or government procurement rules, etc. So really understanding and tailoring your analysis and view and the way you engage with the risks that are involved in the business. The other things that were different were the type of people involved in a financial services company, the type of experts, the type of expertise, more financial, more marketing, more sales versus your engineering bases of the GE. So quite different. You tended to be working in high-rise buildings in the banking, and you tended to be working in low-rise buildings out in rural, in suburban areas in GE. So, but they all teach you a lot. They teach you how to deal with people, how to analyze risks, how to be adaptable across different situations. And that's sort of the nature of compliance. It gives you an ability to do almost anything you want if you've got the attitude and willingness to sort of grow and learn.
So since you are quite experienced when it comes to compliance, I'm very curious about your opinion. What kind of skills and what kind of thinking are needed if you want to become an efficient and successful compliance officer?
Yeah, look, I think the first thing I'd say about compliance is it's a very, what I say is a very broad church. I'm not quite sure how that translates into your idiom and language, but it means there's people from all walks of life come and do compliance, and you need all walks of life. So there might be people who have a legal training, there might be people who have a analytics training, there might be ex-regulators, there might be people really good at operations. A whole range of people can be successful in compliance. So, and to be successful in compliance, and more as we go on, we're going to need a whole different mix of skills. We're going to need data and technology skills. We're going to need always the ability to influence, the ability to sell what we're trying to contribute to the organization and persuade people to take it up. So I think to be really successful, you need to have a bit of everything. But really important, I think, at its fundamental and sort of a gating item for anyone is you need to have very high integrity. You need to have a moral compass and backbone that makes you want to do the right thing, makes you want to drive to see and get things right, to call things out. If you find they're not what the organization expects or the regulation expects or society expects, and raise it up. But also to have the ability to provide solutions, provide a way forward across a range of different areas. So the unique aspect about compliance is we are expected to understand the regulation and the obligations. We are expected to understand the products or services that the organization sells. We're supposed to understand the operational processes and how the organization works, who's responsible for what, and then be able to understand where the risks are that the organization facing, distill that into policy, bring that out to a change program, get organizations to follow them and then monitor and test them and report on them. So that's a lot. There's a lot of skills required in that. And some people will be really good at writing a policy. Some people will be really good at going and doing an audit or a monitoring review. Some people will be excellent at sitting at a table and making strategic points and spotting issues and jumping in with a seat at the table. Not everyone's got everything, but there's always a place for subsets of those skills and for people to work together across the function and also across other areas like op risk or legal or first line areas. So lots of skills, but I think ultimately you need integrity and you need to be able to work with people and be able to bring the best of everything to the table for the organization, which, as I say, is a lot, but that's what makes the role so interesting.
And how can you convince business that you are a support function? I mean, that you try to support them in a safe way and you are not just a no man and you are the one who can help them to do business in a prudent way. How can you convince them?
Yeah, I think it's one of the skills of the job is knowing when to say yes and knowing when to say no.
And no must mean no.
And no must mean no, yeah. So and being able to stick to your principles.
Yeah, absolutely.
But, you know, it's and no because, no but do it this way, no. There's some things that are just from a conduct point of view. We're not always dealing with good characters. We're not always dealing with people with risk maturity. And sometimes our interests are at conflict with that. Sometimes we'll find, and more rarely as time goes on, but you find people who are motivated by a revenue target or a goal or their own bias to do certain things, which you know. Even with all the problem solving and trying to get it to work is not going to be good for the organization long term. And we're more likely to be there for the long term than those people. So you've got to play a long game. You've got to have a good sense of where things are going. But, you know, I find that the best managers, the really effective managers and leaders, they want us there. They want to know the real deal. They want to know what's the problem? What are we worried about? But they do want us to be able to say, okay, I get that. Your business goal is this. How do we work through that? How do you do whatever the product or service is, providing it's in the interest of the customer and it's got framing as being the sort of right products on strategy that fit with the organization's values, then how do we navigate the technical? How do we navigate the operational? How do we roll our sleeves up and say, look, if you do it this way, I can live with that because I think it's a good outcome for everyone. That's a real skill and that's something you don't get just coming out of college or university or school. It's important to be around good compliance practitioners who can teach that. So more and more as we go through the professionalization of compliance and the growing up of compliance, we've got more people to turn to who have been there for 20 or 30 years who can say, look, that's not how you do it this way. And that's partly why I do what I'm doing in Australia. We're building up the profession of people who can, in the next 5, 10, 15 years, keep taking the profession forward.
Mm.
Hopefully I'm passing on the skills and knowledge of, you know, almost 30 years in this space in 4 different organisations, including working offshore and onshore, and trying to get the mix of that right and make people clear what is the operating model, what is the role, what is the mandate, what are the risks we should worry about, what has blown up before that we don't want to happen again, how do you get a team and function to work together, how do you get the right culture in your own function to have that sense of support, because it can be a pretty lonely job
mm-hmm.
when you're often the only person in the room saying this don't work and you need your support from your own tribe, which is your compliance family. So, and hopefully more people in the organization, but it is really important to, as a profession, keep understanding that what we do is important, what we do is difficult, but it is growing up. It's like an infant turned into a toddler and turning into an adolescent. It's nowhere near mature yet, anywhere I've seen, and that's part of the exciting part. There's plenty of change, there's plenty to learn.
And what are the key challenges that compliance teams face? Do you have a special and maybe secret recipe to overcome them?
Sure. So I think the typical challenges a compliance team face, look, it depends on the stage of evolution of your organization you work in and the culture there and where your compliance function's at. Almost inevitably, when I've joined compliance functions, it's been a journey to build it up. The function wasn't necessarily regarded with the status that I think it needs and the seat at the table that it needs. So earning that seat at the table, getting the right quality and capacity of people in to do the job requires a lot of almost paving the way for that, of making the case, explaining the risks, putting a proposition of what you need, getting the budget, hiring the people, getting them to work. Not everyone you hire will work, work out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, executing stuff over time so you build credibility and build the right to get more resources and more ability to influence and improve things. So that's sort of a virtuous cycle when you get going. But when you start, it's really hard because there's almost a preconception that wherever the organization is good enough when it most likely isn't.
Mm-hmm.
Getting the catalyst for change is hard. And sometimes regulators and fines and other things provide that catalyst. It's not the ideal way to do it, but that often happens. That's a challenge, getting a seat at the table, getting the right resources, getting the right place in the organization, and understanding what we do. I think other challenges that I think are typical are organizational model. What's the role of compliance compared to different areas, whether it might be legal or it might be op risk or it might be your CRO or it might be the first line, and being clear what our job is, what's within that, what are you responsible for is always important, and having the organization clear on that. I think as we go forward, the job's changing. So it's going to be around ensuring that we can use technology, we can use data, we can access different parts of the organization to understand what's going on in a more effective, efficient way than probably we've done in the past. So that's a good challenge to have.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, you get different cultures. I've been in some businesses that are a joy to work with and everyone's going in the same direction. Unfortunately, at other times when you're most needed is when it's the most difficult, when you're fighting a culture that doesn't work and you're calling stuff out and you're raising issues. And then it can be the time when you just got to play through it and get to the other side. But then you've got to have the courage of your convictions and you've got to realize, you know, have a really good understanding of your expertise and your radar for risk so that you can stand your ground on that. So I think I might have sort of, how do you overcome them? I think as much as possible, have a plan,
mm-hmm.
set out a plan early on. What is your strategic plan? Where do you want to take the function? What are the risks and what do you need to do to mitigate them? And present that plan ideally to the executive and then the board to get the buy-in. Because once you've got that, life becomes easier. And one thing I will say is if you've got a cogent plan and you can point out the risks, there's not too many boards out there in the world who will say, I'm prepared to take that risk on compliance, on complying with laws. They will back you if they believe that what you're telling them is sensible, pragmatic, has the right proportionality, but also that you're passionate and committed to it. And that's been my experience throughout. So if you don't ask, you don't get. So you need to have a plan. Just wallowing in, you know, I don't have the resources, or I don't have this, or the business doesn't get it, that's your problem in 6 months' time as a compliance officer. So you need to have a plan. You need to be showing progress. You need to be really clear in documentation where the risks are, what you're calling out, what you're worried about. And you need to also make sure your part, your function, your team is delivering, is showing that it's turning up, that it's really making a difference, because that's also a fairly robust protection for you if something goes wrong. You say, look, I've improved all these things. Because it is a job where things can go wrong, and often compliance can be a part of the organization. Everyone says, well, why didn't compliance spot that? Why didn't you call that out? Why didn't you fix that? And that's where having that plan, having the logic, showing the progress provides a point of protection, a point of demonstration that this is what you've been doing and why what you've been doing has been value add to the organization as a whole, and discharging your responsibility, which is to manage the compliance risk or provide the framework and approach to do that, and then to ensure people are held accountable for their various areas.
What challenges has COVID-19 created, and how have you overcome them?
Yeah, look, a lot of effect. I think it's been a remarkable time. I'm sure it has been for everyone. So just like most countries, you know, we haven't been to work, or most of our teams haven't been to work since February, March. So right there's a big difference. Everyone's working on Teams and WebEx or whatever else, on videos. As a compliance function, I lead about 300 people. Probably 50 of them are joined in the last 9 months, mm-hmm. and I haven't met them yet, and they haven't met other people. So that changes the nature and ability to team as well as we might like. Mm-hmm. It puts a lot of premium on collaboration tools like, you know, your video tools. Remarkably, it's worked pretty well overall. Like, you know, I think my team's doing a remarkable job, and I think I'll hear that from other firms as well. From a risk point of view, we've had some pretty core things that have happened in the business. So a lot of our offshore processing overnight got shut down. We had to bring a lot of processing work back into the country and then manage that huge volume and then look at the operational risk and regulatory risk coming out of that. We have less ability to monitor or surveil what people are doing or know what's happening. Data privacy and potential leakage and issues like that go up. Various, obviously, customer impacts, such as just people not being able to meet their responsibilities and liabilities, and then all the impact that puts on collections and vulnerable customer dealings and good conduct for customers, all comes into play. So, yeah, a range of different impacts that none of us probably had an inkling of foreseeing, despite all our emerging risk maps and everything else. And I think it's going to change how we think about work. It's going to change how we think about teamwork and adaptability. So I think that's going to be profound. But I do think that, to me, the insidious and pervasive element that worries me is the impact on culture and disconnection from work environments, mm-hmm. that we need to somehow compensate for and get people back in the office as much as we can, as soon as we can. But also recognize that we are ultimately social beings. We ultimately want to be around people. And, you know, we need to try and rebuild once this thing's over. And please God, it is.
Yeah, and it's really hard. I just lead a team of 30. But now I have 5 people who I've never seen in life. So it's hard to be a team with them. And another side effect of this new happening is that there was a lady who just quit, and she was very important for our compliance directorate. And I'm more than sure that she wouldn't leave if we had a chance to talk with each other in person to solve the issues and stuff, because right now I'm just a picture for my team and the voice. So it's really, really hard to be a leader when you are not blood and flesh. You are just a picture, just an avatar, just a voice. It is really hard to lead your team and to do your audits and to maintain healthy compliance culture. So it's really a challenge for all of us, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah, but I think you just have to persist. And I think, I think it's just trying to find innovative ways to stay connected and be human is really important.
We're going to survive. I'm more than sure we're going to survive, but it's a challenge. Let's face the music.
It is. Yeah, it really is.
And another challenge is that more and more compliance departments facing budget cuts. So what practices should be prioritized to maintain healthy compliance culture and ethical business conduct? What factors should be considered when balancing cost against effectiveness?
Yeah, that's a really hard question. So I suppose that my own personal history on this is that over the 20-odd years I've been leading compliance functions, I don't think my budget's ever gone down, largely because of the stage of different places I've been in and the growth we've been on to get right. I appreciate that sort of in some bigger organisations that have been more mature and probably grew a lot further and faster, They're going through cuts. I think it depends on the nature of your organisation and where it's at. If our organisation decides to stop four lines of business and close down three countries, then I can definitely reduce the compliance function. If its culture gets better and its first line teams get more mature and take more of the load and I'm more check and challenge, I can have a lesser function than I have. If the number of incidents and issues or remediation goes down, then I can have lesser function than I have. So a lot of it does come down to where the organization is and the activities that are generated and the work. By the same token, if I'm having more issues and incidents than ever, if we're high risk from a regulatory point of view, and if everyone wants you to do a whole lot more and you want to cut, that's not going to work. And that's just going to sow the seeds for future remediations and fixing. Most leaders now get that if it's well explained to them. And prevention being better than cure in this place, it does cost you a lot more to be non-compliant than to be compliant. So the trick of it all is to be able to size, explain why you need the capability you need and capacity you need to do the work that is there at any given point in time. And to, whether that means a 10% increase or a 10% decrease, it depends on that. And that's where you need to have a really robust dialogue and then be able to call that out and hopefully have the support of the board, risk committee, or whoever it is who has a responsibility to oversee this at a board level. So I think then there is going to come a time when technology, culture, operational process, compliance by design elements converge to the point where a lot of what we do can be done a lot more efficiently than sort of the manual and people-based work we do today. I'm just not sure when that time is or how far away it is, when RegTech really gives us meaningful advances and help, when organizations who are basically an organism of people, if you don't have the impetus to keep on it, then it's very easy to slip back into bad practices. So that's why organizational culture is there. And that's why you always need a strong second line capability to test and challenge and keep it stable. Otherwise, you'll slip back again. So I don't have a lot of experience in cost cutting and compliance. I get nervous. If I was in an organization which had grown like some of the big ones have, then I fully get it. I think it's been overbaked and there'll be some shedding. But if you're an organization of 30 or 50 or 100 and your organization as a whole is generating a lot more compliance risk than you're doing, I don't think you should be cutting.
And as for the last question, compliance seems to be more and more important all around the world. How do you see the future of this profession? When will be the first CEO with a compliance background be appointed?
Look, I think it is more and more important all around the world. I think it's a very bright future in terms of the capability and the need.
Amen.
And I think it's a fascinating discipline. I think as a profession, we've got a bit of a branding problem with what people think compliance is who don't do it. Mm-hmm. I've thought for a long time what is a better name for it, but I haven't really landed on anything, and it'd be too hard to change it now. But it's not compliance as in box ticking. It's not compliance as in you know, getting out a red pen and ticking things. It's compliance in a strategic sense of understanding the organization's goals and objectives and trying to help it get there safely and trying to make sure the customers get the right outcomes as per what the organization's striving for. So that's important. And then I think the future of it is far more integrated activity with operations and other parts of the organization where you surf the wave of what's happening. So you're not trying to build a compliance process, you're inputting compliance elements into the process and being able to leverage that. I think compliance has to have a strong voice, has to be respected. You have to have a strong speak-up culture, which we foster and nurture. Mm-hmm. We have to have the gateway to the regulators and the relationships there. We need to be best friends with a whole bunch of functions like government relations, legal, op risk, you know, culture people, divisional business leaders, and build those relationships and be the person that people want in the room to help sort this stuff out.
Mm-hmm. We have to set the right tone from the top as well, because it's very important to have a good relationship with the management.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. And we need to be able to be trusted by them. So, that, you know, I see there's two balancing elements of this. There's a trusted advisor element and there's a guardian or independence aspect, and you need to balance those. You know, you need to be a trusted advisor, but that doesn't mean telling them what they want to hear. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. And people respect that. The good people respect that. So turning to your question of, so when will a CEO be DNA from compliance? Like, there's no reason it shouldn't be. I think there's going to be people with that caliber and way. I think there's probably an innate DNA point, which is we may not be the most entrepreneurial or sales or risk-taking people, and CEOs tend to be that. Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a bias against that role being there. I think that's also, as time goes on and where we spend our time, and as I say, that technology futurist aspects, then that could be a real opportunity. I think there'll be some organizations that lend themselves more than others. I doubt that a big major bank is anytime soon going to have a compliance professional run it, but I imagine some very heavily regulated smaller organizations could. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's the path that starts it off. Certainly there's been a hell of a lot of lawyers who end up CEOs, and it's not that far away.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Jamie. It was fun talking to you.
Well, thank you, Andreas, and thank you, everyone. I hope you got something out of that. And it's a great initiative you're driving, and I wish you all the luck with keeping on getting people to give their insights. And, good luck with running your team, and good luck to everyone managing through this crazy COVID world.
Thanks for joining me today. You have just listened to The Defense Lines, the podcast for the control functions. If you found value in this episode, please subscribe so you will never miss a show. András Bácsfabi is signing off, but till our next meeting, do not forget, those who try to convince you that safety can be increased only by jeopardizing your business goals will eventually deprive you of both.